You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Dr. Julia F. Christensen, Danish neuroscientist, former dancer, and current senior scientist at the Max Planck Institute for Empirical Aesthetics. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
This actually also links to the rise of AI and the implications that that has for the arts world and for us as creators. So as we produce, let's say, shapes on a paper, or with our body, we conform to an aesthetic standard, or we make music that sounds in a specific way. So syncopation is now the big thing. It will induce people to groove and to like your music more. So let's have a lot of syncopation inside your music and you'll sell a lot. So by doing this chase for the beauty, for this superficial beauty, which is what AI gives us at the moment, it gives us perfect outcomes. Not that any of what they produce, these models, is perfect, because how do you evaluate perfection? But they are based on the data that most people want to see again. So that is extremely important to bear in mind. And so when you say cluttered mind, that is actually also a cluttered brain in the sense of what neurotransmitters are out and about there. So as we strive after that perfect coding and that external beauty, our brain, again, has all these little dopamine signals. Dopamine is good. Dopamine is a learning signal to the brain, but we need to know how to use it. So if we constantly swipe our phone, get this beauty into our brain, basically by our eyes in this case, or via the syncopations and the music, we are teaching our mind to seek that all the time, because that's a dopamine signal. It's a learning signal. So that clutters your mind to strive after these shapes and this kind of sound cue or whatever it is repeatedly. So that clutters your brain, and that's why your mind is full. So this is a process that we're only starting to uncover now, which is also why it's important to work with people who are not just hardcore neuroscientists, who can tell you about how the brain interacts with its environment. Because what it does is that it teaches us an unrestful mind, a mind that can't stay put. The state of being in flow and seeking out that state, sort of disappearing from the here and now, if you will, it must have been something that has been part of the human cultures for many millennia, because we know that, for example, dancing can bring you into these states. And we know from many anthropological work and graphic work today that people dance themselves into trance, a type of flow, for example. So there is that of flow in this scientific sense of a state of well-being. So there's something about this flowy synchronousness in nature and us as part of that nature that is beneficial, for example, for the social connectedness of beings. So if I feel more connected to you, I will be more willing to do something for you, to collaborate with you. And funny enough, we seem to be more coordinated and also solving problems. We would distinguish between the state of flow, this feeling of being completely absorbed into an activity so that time and space disappears, somehow compresses or expands. We do it for our intrinsic motivation, and we feel that skill and our depth, the challenge of what we're doing, are in perfect harmony. So it's neither too difficult nor too easy. And we have a clear goal in what we're doing. We know what we want to achieve. There's no competitiveness. We're just doing it because of the pleasure of doing it. So my first experiences with flow was clearly with playing, as probably most people. When you speak about flow to people, usually if they're not creative professionals, they will say, that's something I did as a child, and why should I care now? And then I quickly come in and say, because the science shows if you do this often, you will be healthier. The question is to describe it and then how to find it, of course. And the way I found it, well, as a child, I had it, and as probably all of us have. And then rightly, as you say, we unlearn it, because it is no longer part of our culture to encourage play and to submerge yourself into anything without it having a grade at the end or some financial benefit. And these are behaviors that are not conducive to flow and that teach our mind to be very restless. This is, of course, something that I did not know. So as we're talking about my journey in and out of this flow state and back into it, my next experiences with flow were dancing in my parents' living room to the LPs that they had. it was a very natural thing to be doing. And I was enrolled in a dance education early. My path was to become a dancer. So I had never had a life without dancing, without having this flow. Of course, as I moved into professional ballet education, it became also a lot about technique and routines and competitiveness in a sense. But the flow was always with me because that was where I came from. But I remember once someone asking, so have you now learned all the movements of ballet? Or haven't you finished now? Aren't you done now? Can't you know, just stop? And that never occurred to me as a question, but that was someone who had never experienced or had forgotten how that was, that you just use your body not to learn steps, but to express, because that was what it was for me. It was a way of expression. So these contacts with people from outside the art world were always bizarre to me, but I never paid it much attention because I thought that's an outlier. But then because of an accident and severe injury to my back, I did not continue on the dance career side. And I was sort of catapulted out of the dance world and into the world that our culture is without arts. Arts in the general culture is something very, classy for a distinct audience sometimes. And many people that you ask about their art interests will say, I don't understand art, at least in this Western context. So that was a very new experience for me. And luckily, I had always been very interested in human behavior. And I found out that I could study human behavior, if not the dancing of it. And then I could at least study human behaviors, all of them. So I studied psychology, neuroscience, and also human evolution and cognition. And that brought me back to the arts in a very strange way, because doing that, studies and career in academia that brought me to a PhD and then as a scientist working now, I came back to the arts because I found by chance research on expert dancers and how their brains are different from those who don't dance. On flow, research on flow, I thought that was Professor Sisek Mihaly, who's been working on this for decades now. I made this my research career, so in a way I got back to the arts through science. But that still didn't get me my flow back. So that's where the pathway to flow came in.
Yes, it's so interesting what you describe on a personal level, which does happen, unfortunately, with many dancers, that they get injured. But I think it's also a metaphor for the ways in which we've kind of, as a society, 75% of the world by 2050 will be living in cities. And we've kind of fractured our connection with both, as we're talking at the beginning of the conversation, our connection with the natural world and also with us embodied intelligence as physical beings. We've kind of located our intelligence all in our brain. We forget about the rest of our bodies, which is so important. We're not AI creatures. It's all being up in the brain. There's a lot of other stuff, as you know, going on subconsciously. And I recently interviewed Carlos Moreno, which I believe you know, he's the creator of the concept of the 15-minute city, which emphasizes the importance of connected, livable cities. And I wonder how you feel living in cities affects our natural flow and sense of connection to ourselves. These man-made environments with too much cement and gray infrastructure, with not enough green spaces, can just disconnect us from the earth and our own creative expression. So how can we make our outer worlds better reflect our inner needs for calm and connection, and design those spaces and communities that foster our creative flow?
Yes, you are touching on incredibly important points. Actually, one of the seven important points, I would say, regarding how we can live a life that is conducive to flow. And point one is this connection with our body, our physicality. Our body needs around 150 to 180 minutes of aerobic exercise per week. So aerobic means that the heartbeat goes over 140 beats per minute. This number is due to research that shows that if we don't have it, the risks that we have for developing heart disease, diabetes type 2, some cancers, some infectious diseases, increase statistically significantly if we do not have these body movement in our daily life. So 150 to 180 moderate exercise per week is a non-negotiable. Why? For a still mind. If we take such a behavior like sitting, which a lot of us do in our modern urban spaces, man-made is a chair. The sitting, most of us adults in Western world sit around 9 to 10 hours per day. This increases heart disease risk by 34%, and it is a health hazard. The flow was always with me because that was where I came from. But I remember once someone asking, so have you now learned all the movements of ballet? Or haven't you finished now? Aren't you done now? Can't you know just stop? And that never occurred to me as a question, but that was someone who had never experienced or had forgotten how that was, that you just use your body not to learn steps, but to express. So through what we do with our body, we actually influence activation patterns in our brain. And sitting sends signals of danger to the body, to the brain. So what is the danger in sitting? Well, pressure, blood pressure is different when we sit. So that actually is already in the long run a signal to the brain, move, move, do something. You should not be sitting anymore. Then it stresses the lower back because the pelvis is bent forward. Sitting inclined forwards will compress the solar plexus, which also is a nerve bundle under our breastbone. So if we dance, we are de-stressing both the pelvis and the breastbone nerve bundle that sits there, the solar plexus, because we walk backwards or we move our arms up over our head. It's something we do naturally when we dance. When we sit, we do not. And all of these are stresses to the body. They are linked to messaging to the brain that something is wrong. These signals raise to our awareness through the interoception. Our interoception is the sense of our body from within. And this is a nonverbal sense. Dancers, we are always too adaptable. Just like you said, there's no one really taking our stance. What might happen is more that the dancer then recedes into the background and this collaboration never happens because they realize they don't understand me. And my most important work at the beginning of a collaboration is to establish that trust, because obviously on my side of the conversation, there will be more scientists who do not have dance experience and who might not be aware of that. And so that the trust can be there that the dancers will stay in the collaboration is really important to me, and that they speak their mind freely, because there's always the thing of, you know, whoa, scientists, they know so much about the brain. Musicians don't seem to have that much in my experience, maybe because the art form dance is also always a little less appreciated than music, for example. So I don't only work with Western dance forms. And when we open up to work both sides, you know, so both non-Western and Western scientists and artists will open up to work with people across divides as they are nowadays. Other types of words need to be agreed on and understood by both sides. And it's a very rewarding and fun process because you discover stuff about yourself, about the others, and you become this oneness when we come back to this idea of synchronizing ideas and thoughts and physiological rhythms in those teams when we sit together, obviously synchronize, and synergy happens on a physiological level too in this way. We can find inspirations of how people everywhere in the world interact with the arts and find flow and use maybe creative behaviors particularly to get into flow and get the benefits, health and social and physical health-wise. So my most, let's say, formative experience, I think, I mean, you mentioned Spain and you mentioned France. I've lived in these countries, but I've actually had a project since 2016 with Iranian researchers and dancers and artists, and was privileged enough to learn about a different conception of how the arts are viewed in that particular culture, and how dancing, for example, is also underestimated as well. So there are like intervention studies showing that creative writing, for example, it can be conducive to better health indices. So people who write expressively, just 20 minutes, twice a week, for a period of time, throw it away afterwards, don't show it to anyone, just express, download it to the page. After 6 months, they have less doctor's visits, better health indices, like better immune markers, better wound healing. And that's without this outcome focus. Okay, so there's science that shows, hey, we should try to give people back this joy of playing with whatever I have in my hand right now, be that wool that I'm knitting or crafts, materials that I put together in ways that just please me in this very moment. And it doesn't matter what it becomes at the end. So that's very important. So maybe you have a creative practice, but you don't seem to be able to submerge you into it. Well, try with that movement. Try to have that for a couple of weeks. Maybe you will suddenly be able to submerge yourself into that book you like reading or that writing that you always wanted to do, just because you gave your brain that move. Then if we're already struggling with focus, which many of us are from many different, so that might be anxiety, that might be ADHD, it might be depression, it might be some social phobias. There are many reasons for having this cluttered mind. So for each, there will be different ways. But one important thing is to understand what these mind hooks are. Could I have ADHD? Is that maybe why I can't sit for so long? Or am I sitting in my work for 9 hours straight? And that's why my body just won't do it. My mind won't empty itself. It's not possible to empty your mind if your mind is full. Our brain will never be off. Like, it will always be on because it's keeping us alive. And if there's signals from the body telling it, move, you will not be able to focus. So that movement junkie of a brain needs to be appeased. And then teach your brain to know about these three mind hooks, and then maybe look at how do I actually create a practice so that in our busy, busy lives, we don't have time to submerge ourselves in hours of flow every day, but we might need flow every day. So how to get it for 5 minutes, just like take away 5 minutes. Well, I have to create the habit in my brain. And so I spent some time in the book explaining how to do that.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.